Given the nature of this group and the preparation that I know at least a good many of you have had in terms of reading my books and the limited amount of time at our disposal and our mutual desire to get to a, you know, a Q&A period, to get into some dialogue, I'm not going to give you a talk that tells you everything that's wrong with Darwinism or that really goes into the scientific critique. I'm going to assume that probably most of the people here are aware of that and don't need to be persuaded that there's something wrong with Darwinism. And I'm going to give you just a brief summary of what I see the basic issue as being, and then explain the strategy that I have in place for dealing with it, and how we're coming along with that, and what we're trying to do and accomplish. Now, first, what the basis of Darwinism, what is it, and what's it about? The important thing to understand is that we're not talking about simply some harmless idea that there has been some evolution, that there has been some variation, that there are some changes in nature that science can study and so on. No, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a system that means to give an answer to the question, how do you get all the creating done without assigning any role to a creator? How do we get along with the job of creation once we assume God is outside of reality, that nature is all there is, that nature is a closed system of material causes and effects. And that we assume this for the purpose of generating further knowledge. We call this methodological naturalism. And once this philosophical premise is in place, then something very much like the neo-Darwinian evolutionary synthesis simply has to be true as a matter of logic. You don't need evidence to know that. And that's why Richard Dawkins can go around the world giving lectures on universal Darwinism, which is his proposition that if life exists on distant planets where we'll never observe it, it will have evolved by Darwinian selection, because it's the only thing that could have happened. You need to start with random combinations and chemical laws because that's all that's available. And then you need, in addition to that, something to take the role of the designer. As Dawkins brilliantly puts it at the beginning of his book, The Blind Watchmaker, biology is the study of extremely complex things that look as if they were designed by a creator for a purpose. So you have to get something in there that can do that, a designing job in place of the creator, and that, of course, is the Darwinian mechanism, the accumulation of micromutations through natural selection, or just natural selection for short. So once you understand this, then you understand, a frequent theme of my writing, why Darwinists are so easily convinced that the whole thing is true. If you're at all outside of the system and a skeptic, you will hear an explanation of the peppered moth, the observations, the finchbeak variations on the Galapagos, and your reaction will probably be as mine is, you know, how could anybody possibly think that these trivial variations within fundamentally stable types give you the answer of how you get the massive job of creation done so that you get birds and trees and moths and scientific observers in the first place. It's a plainly ridiculous chain of inference if you're at all skeptical about it. But Darwinians are not at all skeptical about it. They know it fundamentally has to be true on philosophical grounds, and so any demonstration that natural selection can do anything at all, and there are really very few of them, is to them convincing proof that it can do everything. And if you challenge that, their answer will be, what is your alternative? And that is the trump card that Dawkins can always play against people like his great adversary, Stephen Jay Gould, who probably doesn't believe in the creative power of natural selection any more than I do, although sometimes he gives it lip service, but never with any of the enthusiasm that would indicate to you that he really believes it. He cannot come up with an alternative, nor can anyone else, and so Dawkins will hold the field against him every time with that trump card. Within the Christian world, a lot of confusion has been generated, I think, and still is being generated by the notion that is very widely put about that it's perfectly innocent and harmless activity to adopt a methodological naturalism as a scientific method, provided you are clear that it doesn't say God doesn't exist, it just says that God is ruled outside of consideration when we're doing science. So you can be, to use the jargon of the trade, a methodological naturalist and an ontological theist. One can do that without formal logical contradiction, it's true enough. But it isn't a very convincing position, it's a very awkward fit, because, as I like to put it, if a science founded on methodological naturalism goes continually from triumph to triumph, making new discoveries along the way, and if science done on theistic premises always leads to error or delusion, such as the famous God of the gaps and ultimate embarrassment, and if even theists concede that methodological naturalism is the only thing to employ if you want to get to any further truths, then the likely explanation for this state of affairs is that naturalism is true and theism is false. It'd be rather odd to have a system where theism were true and naturalism were false, and yet naturalism always works and theism never does in terms of generating new knowledge. While being a devotee of methodological naturalism and its scientific results certainly does not make it impossible to be a Christian, even a very pious one, because we see many examples of people who manage just this feat. What it does do is intellectually marginalize them. This is why the universities have gone, and George Marsden's history so brilliantly demonstrated, from Protestant establishment to established unbelief, which is to say, established naturalistic philosophy as the official religion of the universities. It's why, in fact, methodological naturalism has become orthodox even in the theological seminaries, present company excepted, where one finds methodological naturalism applied to the Bible, for example, and the higher criticism, the quest for the historical Jesus, and so on. And indeed, why not, if it is the accepted a way to come to new knowledge in the academic world. And in fact, I would say that methodological naturalism is far more dangerous than the outright ontological kind. Because when somebody says, I am a metaphysical naturalist, an ontological naturalist, nature is all there is, God is a myth, an imaginary creature like Santa Claus for grown-ups, you are on your guard as a theist that you have a position to debate here and that a great deal is at stake. But when he says, oh, I wouldn't for the life of me challenge your deeply held religious beliefs, which I sincerely respect, but if we're going to, you know, be rational here, let's assume naturalism, then something is being slipped under your guard. And as you learn to think that way, year after year, you will end up perhaps without realizing it, at a position that is effectively naturalistic in all respects. And of course, we see this happening everywhere and continually. Now, what does one do about this situation, and how can it be challenged? I go into the description of the situation first because I think that makes it clear why you cannot challenge the rule of naturalistic theories of creation simply by attacking them on the facts. If that could be done, Steve Gould has done it with tremendous skill. Also some creationist debaters have had success on various points, but it doesn't really matter because at the end of the day, the scientific world and the academic world goes on as before with the same methodology. And if you accept naturalism as the methodology, you cannot escape from Darwinism. I've seen this with many critics of it. They end up coming back to it. They go to talk about something like self-organizing systems, which is just, talk, and that never really gets fleshed out with experimental validation. And in the end, Darwinism turns out to be perhaps a crooked game, but the only game in town, and all the gamblers come back to playing it. So you cannot attack it without getting at the underlying method and the assumptions behind it. Now, that's the starting point for my own efforts and for the group of which I am the unofficial or de facto leader that we call the Wedge. The Wedge is a very loosely organized group consisting of all of the people who are pursuing this general intellectual agenda and are in contact with me. I'll tell you a little about some of them in a moment. The wedge metaphor that we use, this is described in my most recent book, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds, refers to the way in which you split a seemingly impregnable log by putting a sharp edge into a crack and widening the crack by driving the wedge into it. So in the metaphor, my own work is the thin edge of the wedge that makes the initial penetration, and those coming behind broaden the wedge by turning it into a complete intellectual program gradually and over time. Now, best known of the members of the Wedge, besides myself at the moment, is the biochemist Michael Behe of Lehigh University, author of Darwin's Black Box, who's had a tremendous triumph in publishing with the Free Press in New York, a major trade publisher, a book, Darwin's Black Box, that advances the thesis that biochemical systems at the molecular level are and can be seen to be irreducibly complex. They consist of a great many parts. All the parts have to work together or nothing happens. No part makes sense by itself, so you can't build them up step by step through a mindless process. An intelligent creator could assemble them step by step because the creator can look ahead and plan, but a mindless process can only preserve things that are useful right now. The molecular biologists don't even attempt to present Darwinian scenarios for these irreducibly complex systems. We see that although Behe's conclusion that this points to the reality of a designer is hotly debated and rejected on philosophical grounds by the very doctrinaire materialists who dominate that discipline, in fact, they are making the same description of the systems that he is. We're just circulating on the internet a piece by Bruce Alberts, president of the National Academy of Sciences, that sounds as if it was written by Michael Behe, you see, in describing molecular machines and their irreducible complexity, although Alberts would be infuriated if anyone suggested that he had any doubts about the adequacy of the Darwinian mechanism, which he holds as a matter of faith. So this is a start to the Wedge a process. In the future, we have books coming along that I think are going to be very interesting. The next one to come out from Cambridge University Press is by my friend and colleague William Dembski, who has PhDs in mathematics from the University of Chicago and philosophy from the University of Illinois, Chicago Circle, or maybe it's the other way around, as well as a master's degree from Princeton Seminary. Bill is a pretty formidable intellect, as you can imagine. And he is publishing this book from Cambridge Press on the legitimacy of the design inference. We have others, Stephen Meyer, a professor of philosophy at Whitworth College, will be publishing along with some other friends of mine on this subject, is also pursuing this line of showing that the notion of intelligent causes is very legitimate in science, and that you do use the notion of intelligent causes every time a detective solves a mystery and discovers that a death, you know, by heart attack was really poisoning, or an archaeologist deciphers some squiggles on a cave wall and decides that they are a painting rather than features of erosion, or even the arch naturalist Carl Sagan scans the heavens for intelligent signals from outer space, which can be known by their irreducible complexity, if you like, or their conveyance of meaning, and so on, that this is a perfectly legitimate concept in science. And so at this rather high academic level, we're attempting to undo the prejudice with which scientific materialists approach this subject. They tend to think that if you bring the notion of intelligence into the world of biology, you've turned it into magic. And in fact, they constantly will say this, you see, we wouldn't do science at all then because everything would happen as the result of capricious spirits. You see, so in meeting that, now I do this at a more simple rhetorical level. Dembski does it with one of these academic books full of mathematical symbols and all. But the way I put it is that the computer is intelligently designed and we all use them. That doesn't mean that it's a mysterious black box that works by voodoo. You see, it operates according to physical laws, but that fact that it does do so in no way tends to prove that Bill Gates, who really is a capricious spirit in many ways, does not exist. So you see that, you know, you have to consider the intelligence in the design, but that in no way takes the computer outside of the ken of science. Likewise, once you begin to think this way, it's perfectly obvious that biological organisms fit into that same kind of way of thinking. Even the most materialistic Darwinists now talk about information in biological systems being a different kind of stuff from the chemical matter in which it's encoded. And all I have to do is realize the meaning of what they're saying, which so far they don't, you see, and they will be matter-information dualists. And the information, of course, is what reflects the designing mind. It's the same thing with a book. Whether it's the works of Shakespeare or a humbler product like one of my books, the book is not just ink and paper, and you cannot understand the information in the book by understanding the laws that govern the combining of ink and paper. So we have a whole literature coming out that's one thing making that point in various ways at different levels of academic sophistication and complexity to bring the concept of intelligence into the mainstream scientific consciousness against, of course, fierce resistance. But the resistance is purely philosophical. It isn't because they're differing on the facts. Now, that leads us to a somewhat broader program along the same lines that the agenda for biology, in my view, at the present time, once one realizes the tremendous trouble that Darwinism is in, with its mechanism really insupportable and unsupported and subject to all these valid criticisms, is to concentrate on discovering the nature of life, the nature of the organism. What is the nature of the thing whose origin we are trying to explain? See, that question must precede the how do we explain its origin question. You have to know what it is you're trying to explain. And this inquiry, I think, will make it clear that the Darwinian system can maintain itself only by making simplifying assumptions of what the organism is. You see, that it's just matter evolving by natural selection. And as you get the inquiry into what the organism is further and further advanced, the Darwinian explanation recedes more and more from any reality or plausibility. And that is why Michael Behe can say that molecular biologists don't publish papers trying to explain how their molecular systems arose by Darwinian means, because they know it just doesn't make any sense. Then as a further a program in this, I'm very interested in recruiting people from the humanities, from sociologists of knowledge, in the theological faculties and all, who are motivated and encouraged and empowered to bring this kind of critique to bear from their own disciplines. Much of what I do in my work, the arguments I use, the intellectual techniques, are accepted as completely standard in areas like sociology of knowledge. You see, and you can see them done everywhere, usually in academic jargon rather than in stuff that the general reader can understand. But they're brought to bear on government policies and academic ideas and so on all the time. The difference is that Darwinism is a sacred cow. Evolutionary theory is held to be so sacred that you just don't do that to it. It's like people used to say nobody deconstructs Marx. Well, they probably do nowadays, you see, but you don't deconstruct the limb on which you are sitting. and the deconstructionists, the postmodernists, the sociologists of knowledge are sitting on that materialistic and naturalistic limb, and so they don't bring their method against it. Perhaps the most outstanding example of that is Thomas Kuhn in his famous classic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the great fountainhead of all the relativism, you know, in sociology of knowledge and all, in which it's perfectly obvious that Darwinism, evolutionary theory, is the best possible example that you could imagine of the Kuhnian paradigm that crosses philosophical lines, you know, that becomes a whole worldview way of looking at the world, that deals with anomalies by either disregarding them or, you know, complicating the system and so on. And yet Kuhn never dared to touch it, or perhaps never thought of touching it because it was sacred to him. So we want to, you see, encourage people to go that extra step and make this a subject of mainstream academic discussion. Why do the Darwinists believe as they do and have the quarrels that they do? As we get that discussion further along, you see, then we desacralize the whole theory. So that's one major part of the theory, of the strategy in terms of bringing the issue to the mainstream of academic discussion. Now, another major part of the strategy that I'm personally particularly involved in is what you might say building a community or even raising an army. That is, in the religious world, predominantly the Christian world, although, you know, God-believing Jews are also to be taken into account here. There are enormous resources. There are an awful lot of people. There are educational institutions. And an enormous amount can be done insofar as the teachers and the students and the young people coming up to become students understand how the thinking is done. What I want to encourage people in the conservative religious community not to do is to think of protecting their young people from modernist thought, particularly the ones who are going to go away to college. The worst thing you can do is to arm somebody with all the standard, you know, arguments for the Bible or whatever, and then send them to Berkeley, where I teach, where they're just going to get blown away in their first courses, not only in science, but in other things. They're going to hear things they don't know about and don't know how to handle. And that's the subject, if you've read my latest book, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds, I start with the story of a student who has done exactly that, and how you can see him moving to theistic evolution, you know, on the way probably to a still more naturalistic understanding of reality. No, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to make sure that our young people not only learn about evolution and evolutionary naturalism and the thinking behind it, but that they learn a great deal more about it than the school authorities want them to know. They learn where the bodies are buried, as I like to put it. They learn what they're going to hear from, let's say, a first-year college course in advance, and what they're not going to hear, and why they're going to hear what they're going to hear, and why they're not going to hear the other stuff, and what the thinking is that generates all of this. And that's basically what I'm teaching in the Defeating Darwinism book, is a how to do that. I want to see the day when we have thousands of these students coming into the classrooms in the academic world saying, yes, we've heard about the peppered moth, and no, it doesn't show anything important about the creative processes in nature, and we know why, and if you, Mr. Professor, aren't up on that, it's about time you did some serious reading. Now, actually, I put that in a rather smart-alecky way. It's probably not the best way to put it. That all they'd have to do is ask about the critiques and say, now, are you saying that this peppered moth example variation is the same creative process that produced moths in the first place? You know, what's the informational content of a moth? You know, to be able to ask questions like that. And pretty soon they'll have somebody stumbling and fumbling, I think. And of course, they have to have reinforcement from others. So, This is one thing that I want to do. The other thing that is very important to me personally is to have as large as possible an understanding, thinking community out there as an audience. What I anticipate happening is that it'll only be a matter of time before the virtual news blackout on this is lifted. It is, until very, very recently, it has been the case that all of the stuff from the Darwinian community and the stuff you'd see in the newspapers continued to present the view that the only objectors to this system are a narrow group of biblical fundamentalists who rely on, you know, Genesis for their information and ignore science and so on. And they've been denying the existence of the kind of movement that I'm talking about because they don't know how to deal with it. They do know how to deal with the old enemy, but not the new one. And they'd have to retrain all their troops, you see, in order to do it. And if they did that, I'd make a contribution towards the effort because that's, you know, I'd love it for them to be teaching all these, you know, evolutionary biologists the ideas of Philip Johnson and Michael Behe, even to combat them. That would be wonderful. So they don't want to do that, but eventually they're going to have to as we build a bigger and bigger community, and I'm looking forward to the moment when the attack will come because they have to stand and fight over this issue. And I am hoping to draw Dawkins and Gould and the others out into public debate, particularly in writing, in front of this knowledgeable community. I don't want them to be able to argue this in front of the Ivy League and the staff of the New York Times, you see. I want them to have to do it in front of a bigger audience. And if so, I don't have any concern at all about how it's going to come out. So that's very much one of the things I'm trying to do in speaking so much as I am in for example, the Southern Baptist community. Now, I think finally, it's important not only to consider strategies for winning the battle, but the long-term objective that we have in mind. I don't have time to go into it very much, but it's something that's very much in my mind and that we need to be beginning to think about. I was with some of your professors here yesterday and talking about the academic plans for the future of this institution, for example, and then the history of the, you know, Southern Baptist Civil War. You know, the subject came up, well, now that we have won, you know, the war, what do we do with the victory? You see, how do we make something really good out of it? And it isn't a victory at all unless we do. I think that's wonderful that people are thinking that way, as they are. This does them enormous credit. And it is the crucial question to ask. What, you know, do we build? Because the methodological naturalists and the scientific materialists will say, only our methods can generate knowledge. Only our methods can generate an interesting program. You can defend the existence of God or the resurrection or whatever it is you want to defend, you know, as doctrines, but they don't go anywhere. You see, whereas believing in methodological naturalism gives you this whole vast academic program that's been so successful. Well, I don't think it has been so successful. I think it's had some successes, to be sure, but it's also led into some disastrous blunders, such as the Darwinian evolutionary theory, which is why that is so central, but others as well. But what does a theist-based academic a program and intellectual agenda look like? You see, that's what the wedge is a starting effort to build. Now, I believe that this will happen, that this will become the agenda of the intellectual world in the future. Because, you see, it is only theism that can provide that will-o'-the-wisp that physics has been chasing, the theory of everything. Physics, chemistry, material science, natural science, is only a theory about how matter interacts with matter to produce certain results. And it reaches its own reductio ad absurdum when you see these efforts to deal with the mind in those terms. Our minds are just the products of material entities bumping into each other, of chemistry combining. And this leads to absurdity. I love to tell the story of Professor Arthur Kornberg of Stanford, Nobel Prize winning chemist who lectured to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science that he was shocked that many otherwise intelligent people did not know that the mind as part of nature is chemistry and only chemistry. And I wrote to him and I said, Professor Kornberg, humble as I am, I can straighten you out on this. I can explain it to you because the reason that they don't believe that the mind is only chemistry is that they have a chemical in their brains which causes them not to believe it. and you have a different chemical in your brain which causes you to believe it. And you see, of course, this is, it's the easiest thing in the world to do. Anybody can do this. This is the reductio ad absurdum of materialism applied to the mind. It devours the mind and its truth-seeking capacities, and as well as devouring notions of purpose to the universe, of an ultimate basis for morality and ethics, and all of those things. The true basis of knowledge, the true established position of a real university, would be a starting point that recognized that the mind exists in the way it does because we are created in God's image. We are created in the image of the greatest mind. The mind has its capacities due to that. They're not simply explicable in material terms. On the other hand, the mind has its limitations for a similar reason, that we are out of the right relationship with that ultimate mind, and that causes us to fall into not only sinful ways of behavior, but sinful ways of thinking that lead us away from the truth. And so I believe that this actually does furnish the basis for scientific knowledge and knowledge of all kinds to relate to each other in a proper relationship. But this position obviously needs to be built up and fleshed out. And so I can leave you with what I hope is the tremendously encouraging message that we are nearing the end of the century of scientific materialism, the century of Darwin, Freud, and Marx, the century in which this kind of thinking overcame all rivals. It's beginning to crack up. There are prospects for doing something decisive about it, and that in turn sets a really exciting educational and intellectual agenda for the 21st century. It makes it a thrilling time to be a young person involved in the life of the mind. So there I am, and now I'd be glad to take your questions. And
what I'd like for you to do is, if you have a question, I'd like for you to walk to one of these microphones so that we can pick up the question as it's posed. Thank you.
Good idea. I've answered every question.
Actually, I have one.
Shut down the life of the mind. It's all been done. Yeah, you can begin. Thank you.
Yeah, I have one. Thank you very much for reflecting and for presenting your case today, and for the brief on the advances that are being made with your agenda with the group in the Wedge. My question is, what's going to happen next post-naturalism? What's going to happen to this group of people in their science and spiritual quest, and so forth? And what about the financial forces behind the promotion of a new science and religion world? Could you respond a bit?
That's a wonderful question. I'll do the best that I can. Now, one has to distinguish the kind of program that I'm talking about, of course, from a Christian apologetics program. It has some utility to apologetics, a lot of utility, I think, but it isn't quite the same thing because it's really only taking you to the recognition of the creator, or the mind behind the universe, and that, you know, you have to take that into account. And one way people obviously can go from that right away is simply to spiritualize the universe, you see, and so pantheism is an option, or they could just, you know, even be just simply arbitrary, say, well, you have to take intelligence and information into account, and that's an arbitrary given, and we won't say any more about it. We actually want to leave those options open because we don't want to square people off from taking the first step, you see, I'll say to them, in fact, you know, you retain all your options, you're just recognizing the reality that you can't deny. So a big work needs to be done, obviously, beyond this program, which only, what it does for apologetics is it sets up a metaphysics within which the Christian message begins to make sense. I mean, you can't talk to people about sin or being out at the right relationship with the Creator if the Creator's imaginary, and if, you know, sin is an obsolete concept that doesn't exist in a naturalistic world. So what we will have, I think, in answer to your question, is a situation not tremendously different from that which the early apostles faced in the first century. where there's philosophy of all kinds shooting around the place, you know, where you have all those gods that Paul encountered in Athens, and options and so on. And then you really have to begin to get a conversation about the truth in these matters going. I like to think that the order of questions is this. The one I'm pursuing now is the creator real or imaginary? Do we need a creator to get the creating done? You see, the second one I want to pursue is, well, if the creator is real, how did we go so wrong? How were all the best and the brightest so fundamentally wrong? The kind of question you ask after the Vietnam disaster. Well, see, now let's read Romans 1 and see if we can find the answer to that, that this is the human project of getting away from God. Well, why did we want to get away from God so badly? Well, this brings up the subject of sin, you see. And we get step by step to the question, which I'm aiming to at the end of this as an apologetics mission, who do men say that I am, and who do you say that I am? But I'm first working to get that first question established, and I definitely think it leaves us with a very dangerous world in which there are many options. Yes?
In light of that, what do you see as the main competition to a theistic position in the future?
What do I see as the main competition to a theistic picture? I think the long-term danger is not the scientific materialism that I am attacking now, because it's vulnerable. That the true alternative to Christianity, going back again to the first century situation, has always been Gnosticism. You see, the God that comes out of nature that we can attain to with some kind of secret knowledge, that, you know, the Teilhard de Chardin form of evolution, that sort of thing. Because I think it's really true that mankind does not live by bread alone, you see, that the spiritual dimension cannot be denied. Materialism is in the long run, a less seductive allure, except for certain intellectual, you know, certain people, than the Gnostic alternative. So it's a new age, if you like. I'd say that, and that's, you see, the God that we can become in control. That's the God who will do our bidding. It's the genie out of the lamp, that rather than the one that makes demands on us. Yes.
How does one get to join your group? Is there any particular place we can write to, or how do we?
You can email me and sort of tell me about what you're interested in doing. Would be the easiest thing to do. And do we have a blackboard or something? It's philjohn@uclink.berkeley.edu, and I have a website where you can also get to me from. It's the World Wide Web. arn.org/arn, or if you just run my name on a web search engine, you'll come to it very readily. So be interested in what you're doing. The Wedge is not an organization in a formal sense. What it basically consists of is a network, mainly an email network, of people that are interested in pursuing these. I'm at the center of the web, as it were, and operate as a kind of broker introducing people to each other where I think, you know, they can be helpful to each other and so on. And then we have a foundation with foundation money, which is providing grants to basically PhD and postdoc people who are doing certain kinds of research. And you know, people can apply for those. We have a three-year program on that, and I don't know what's going to happen, you know, how much future we've got in it, but that's sort of what it exists as.
My second question is, you mentioned that you're fighting it on the level, and basically it will go down to philosophical arguments. Does it mean that anyone who doesn't have who has the intention to do writing on this thing, without a scientific background, can do it?
Oh, yes. I think one can do work in this without a scientific background. In fact, you really need the scientific background mainly if you're going to be debating biologists in public on this, you see, because you have to be able to protect yourself from the bluff. I've had to learn a lot of stuff because of that. In a sense, I sort of feel like what most of the people really need to understand about this is given in the two scientific chapters of my second book, Reason in the Balance, for example, or just a couple of my articles. Once you get the basic idea, you see, then it becomes easy to see how everything fits into place. For example, somebody can shoot the names of a dozen fossils at you, and show drawings of a whale with legs, and so on. And, well, what about that? Do you deny that that's an intermediate and so on? See, at that level, this is very hard to answer. What you need to understand is that the fossil record has been a source of embarrassment to Darwinists from the start. They've never been able to document the step-by-step transitions from one kind of thing into another. They look through the fossil record, a couple hundred million specimens, to find a few things which can fit into their, scenario with an energetic interpretation, and then they ignore everything else. They attribute the problems with the fossil record to the fact that it's incomplete, whereas, in fact, the record is most spectacularly and undeniably anti-Darwinian in the areas where the fossil record is most complete, the marine invertebrates. So you understand a few things like that, and then you're not buffaloed by the individual cases. And moreover, I don't know what your field is or, sort of what you're doing, but my goodness, theology itself is a big field for this, biblical studies. The biblical criticism, the 19th century biblical criticism, is just evolutionary naturalism applied to that subject, and you can do it in its own right. So, excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking my husband has a PhD in philosophy, and he said to me, I wish I could get into this, but I don't have any science. So mm-hmm. I was thinking that whether a person like that can do something that will contribute to.
Well, I can tell you a personal story that your husband might find helpful. I don't usually advertise this fact in front of scientific audiences, but the only biology course I ever had was in high school.
Yeah.
I simply took this up as an amateur intellectual exercise, or you might say the way that a lawyer would prep up on a subject in order to cross-examine, an expert witness 10 years ago. The amount of science that you need to know to understand what Darwinism is about is not that great. It's definitely doable. If you look at the books all use the same examples. The peppered moth, the finch beaks, Archaeopteryx, the hominids, the sickle cell anemia gene, the molecular comparisons. It's just the same stuff over and over again. And then they tell you the story about T.H. Huxley debating Bishop Wilberforce and making a wisecrack, to show the science-religion conflict. It's just the same thing over and over again. It's not that tough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. This question is more of a fact question. You address the world as a closed system, and I think that kind of gets at the laws of thermodynamics. Could you kind of address how other evolutionists get at that?
The thermodynamics issue. Yes, I never raised the second law of thermodynamics issue in those terms, and that's an important qualification, in those terms. And the reason that I don't is because it's become a cliche in the war of the biblical creationists and the Darwinists. And it's just hard to get anybody in the scientific world to think once they hear that. They think, you're one of those crazies that thinks that's a problem. It is a problem. But the thing is this, the second law of thermodynamics is the one that says in rough language, that clocks run down instead of run up, that energy tends to move to a more disordered state from an ordered one rather than the other way around. And so, of course, evolution is the story of, things getting more ordered all the time. Doesn't that violate this fundamental physical principle? Well, the easy answer to that, the superficially, satisfying answer that the Darwinists give is no, it doesn't, because in an open system which is receiving energy from outside, it is possible to have, this move from disorder to order. And in fact, it happens every time we build an airplane or that a baby grows in the womb, you get this increasing order. Well, that's perfectly true. But it misses the point, that you can convert order into disorder, and get to highly organized systems with the input of information. That's what enables the baby to grow in complexity in the womb, and that, of course, is the design that is put into designing that airplane. I use the example of an airplane because of one of the famous metaphors that's been used in this whole debate was by Sir Fred Hoyle, the British astronomer, who said that to start life by chance was about as realistic as sending a tornado through a junkyard and having the junk metal assemble itself into a Boeing 747, you say, as a but of course you can build a Boeing 747 with the input of design, and that doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics. So what you need is an additional principle, you know, which is the information principle. And that's where the intelligence comes in.
I wrote a little note here. I like your idea of driving the wedge in evolution and in it cracking open. It's kind of a target-rich environment. It would appear that one of the biggest trump cards that Christians can take away from the Darwin camp is a trump card of infinite time. For example, if we take away the constancy of the speed of light, the universe itself shrinks in size and the age of the universe shrinks by hundreds of orders of magnitude. Have you looked at the evidence for the non-constancy of light and that it now might be traveling much slower than it did when God said, let there be light? You know, the evidence being the everything red shifted out from and the problems with determining the Hubble constant and those things that are farther away, going faster and all that.
I am, in general, familiar with the issue, and there have been claims that have been made even of measurements that would show that light has been slowing down. But these are very controversial, even in the creationist camp. And my own policy is to stay away, completely away from the age issue. I believe I've got the crucial issue in my teeth right now, and I refuse to be distracted from it. And matters of the kind that you're raising get you involved in a whole forest of technical issues and difficulties. I don't even know what I think about them. And I certainly, know that I don't have much of a ability to persuade people that are more technically advanced than me of anything about them. It's actually a wide open field in some ways. I'm going to be reviewing for First Things a whole series of books and the science religion thing that are coming out. And one of them is by an Israeli physicist named Gerald Schroeder, who's very well reputed, a former MIT teacher and many papers to his credit and discoveries and, all the right qualifications. Nobody's denying that. And he's a Jewish creation scientist from the Torah. And he has published this book also from Free Press in New York that suggests that if you take a relativity time dilation, and he does the calculations, time moves at a different speed under conditions of extreme pressure and gravity. That's part of an implication of relativity. And much slower. And so it's like if you're traveling near the speed of light. And so he says that time at the instant of what's called quark confinement, the creation of matter at the in the earliest moments of the Big Bang, if you take from that standpoint 6 days, guess what it comes out to in Earth time? 16 billion years. That's his way, of dealing with the time question and so on. I frankly have no opinion about it. I don't feel I understand it well enough to have an informed opinion. And I don't care. When I deal with this with the Darwinists, what I like to say is this. I'll give you any amount of time you want. 16 billion, 4 billion years to age isn't enough. 16 billion's not enough. Take 160. Quadruple that. I don't care. However many billion years you would like to have, you cannot make this system work anyway. And I regard it as so fundamentally important to stick to that issue that I put the others, they're kind of an interesting intellectual puzzle. And I'm happy if somebody else who's better qualified to do it takes it on.
Yes. My name's Tony Kleindienst. I'm an advanced Masters of Divinity student here at the seminary. You mentioned in your talk that the general media is in support of Darwinian evolution, and that there'll be, I think you mentioned that there'll be a time where they will come to realization that it's not supportable. You did mention that. I think
that's what I was mentioning is that there are times when they're going to get worried enough about the new attack, what they call the new creationism, that they're going to come gunning for us. That is the scientific establishment with the media support. Yeah.
I was wondering, in your opinion, what would have to happen for that to occur in the media community?
What has to happen? Well, see, this is what I am working on. It's a good question, and I'll try to answer it more specifically than I have previously. And it has to do with the two-pronged strategy that I've been following from the beginning. I want to accomplish two goals, and these will set the conditions, you know, which will make it possible for a revolution to occur. And it has to be set off by, you know, local events and so on, but the conditions can be set in advance. First, I want to legitimate the intellectual issues in the mainstream academic world, the mainstream intellectual world, where these New York Times reporters and PBS people and so on get their thinking from. So when we talk about publishing books with Cambridge University Press and all of this and having these academic symposia that we have in discussions, see, we're trying to take the idea of creation, or to put it negatively, the critique of naturalism, and take it out of the marginalized territory of the Bible colleges and bring it in as a legitimate issue to discuss at Berkeley and Harvard and so on, so that people get used to saying, well, there's two points of view on this. See, that's what the media don't understand. It's not that they want to be censors. It's that they think there's only one rational way of thinking, and that's what they've been taught. So you change that perception. Now, then the other thing that happens is that we awaken the sleeping giant, which is the Christian world. And the reason the giant is sleeping is not so much sleeping, he's conflicted. He's having nightmares, you know, fighting with himself. That is, you see, that everybody's got a different view of this, and they're all fighting each other. The Catholics say it's a Protestant issue. The Protestants are divided between young and old earthers. You know, the Jews are afraid of the Christians, and so on. And I want to state the issue, the reality of the Creator, you see, in a way that creates a central position that unifies rather than divides. Once that happens, it'll make an overwhelming difference in the situation. Because one of the key things that they have to keep the peace is all those bishops and ministers coming out and saying, oh, all intelligent Christians find no problem with this. They say it's only those crazies over there at Southern Baptist seminaries that are, you know, worried, you know, and so what we have to do is build that broad-based coalition. Yes, you're next, I think, and I think you were before the.
All right. Where you were. My name's Tim Pattison, and I'm a first-year student here. It seems to me, from what I've read in your books and other things that I've had to do in studying this semester in particular, that Darwinism and neo-Darwinism don't have any data to back their claim of gradualism. But Mr. Gould has provided us with a rather interesting concept that I think we can tie into and show some of its fallacies as well. And I'd like to ask a series of questions. First of all, would you, for the audience, would you explain or define what punctuated equilibrium is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Gould and his sidekick Eldridge, both of whom I know, have essentially tried to explain away the fossil record problem, right, the absence of intermediate forms and gradual transitions, by saying that evolution occurs in isolated small groups where it never gets fossilized. That's short, very shorthand description.
Given that Mr. Gould's observation may be correct and that he has these instantaneous occurrences of different things, is he just simply rationalizing away the Genesis 1 account where things are created after their kind?
Well, what he is doing, we don't need to get to Genesis 1. What he is doing is just essentially retreating into unfalsifiability. You see, if evolution is always unobservable, then that explains why you don't observe it, you see. But it makes it pretty hard to test whether it's true or not. But I think the big thing I want to say about this is, to some extent, it's all a red herring. Because the real problem, the problem of evolution, is accounting for the irreducible complexity, accounting for the appearance of design. Punctuated equilibrium doesn't have anything to do with that. It doesn't add anything to it. The evolution is still Darwinian. Gould has been forced into a corner in that. He, you know, sends out implications in all directions. But they don't have an alternative to the Darwinian mechanism for building the complexity. So punctuated equilibrium, you know, is a red herring.
Okay.
I think one more, and then I see the policeman approaching to take me back to my cell.
I'm very much encouraged and enthused by your optimism about the outcome of this, the battle going on, and particularly because of, I'm one of those young minds moving into the next century that you're so optimistic about.
That's what I want you to think.
What steps are going on? What do you have in mind to equip people like myself for the next century?
Well, there's a lot that's going on. You see, much of that is what's behind the wedge and all. And there are a lot of different people. You're one of them, and there are a lot of different people of all kinds. And so we're trying to start things in all directions that will get people interested. Now, I would say, I mean, let's just think about people who are going to be either teachers or ministers in the Southern Baptist denomination, let's say, you know, or some similar. It doesn't even matter if that's the particular denomination, but I assume that's what we'd be talking about here, and whether they're in pastoral work or any kind of college teaching or even, you know, at some other level. An enormous amount needs to be done in making people aware of how to think about this. You see, to help people to get out of the Bible versus science stereotype, which is a loser, you see, which never reaches more than a deadlock and ends in this cultural isolation, and understand how that thinking is done. Understand why superficial reconciliations won't work to counter the theistic evolution tendency, but also to help bring the youngsters out of that marginalization that comes from just getting the, you know, the Bible stuff, and prepare them really to deal with these problems in their future, you know, as they go forward. So, intellectual work isn't done by everybody, you see, but in every congregation and every school, there's going to be people who can be inspired. And, you know, who will go ahead and who will really make a difference. So, I mean, that's one of the things I want people to do, to help develop with educational materials and all that. If they have the ability to do it in the background, you know, then they can be part of the cutting edge of knowledge. But that's just one of the things you can do to make a difference. There's lots of other ways to do it. So.